wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm John Nelson. Today, Bill Resnick speaks with Jane Slaughter, longtime editor of the monthly publication Labor Notes, about the life and work of Mike Parker. We'll also hear from Patricia Kahlberg, reading from an article she published in Street Roots, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker as they discuss The Color of Law by Richard Rothstein, and finally, Larry Bolden reviewing Diane Chamberlain's book, The Last House on the Street. First up, Bill Resnick talking with Jane Slaughter about Mike Parker, who passed away in January. Parker worked as an electrician in Detroit's auto assembly plants. He was also a labor organizer and a brilliant but accessible writer, dedicated to a vision of socialism from below, not only as a goal but as a strategy for organizing. He argued that the self-organization of the working class could only be achieved through deeply democratic forms of collaboration and decision-making. Mike Parker wrote several books on organizing, including two with Jane Slaughter, offering strategies for taking on phony corporate participation schemes. His book, Democracy is Power, gave workers a roadmap for creating militant, effective unions. Here's Bill Resnick speaking with Jane Slaughter in remembrance of Mike Parker.
Hi, folks. Last month, the rank-and-file labor struggle, the struggle from below, had lost a wonderful, brilliant, selfless comrade, Mike Parker. Born in a union family, Mike joined the Young People's Socialist League at the University of Chicago. He was friends with Bernie Sanders. Then at Berkeley, he was a graduate student. He got active in the student peace movement and the free speech movement. That led the free speech movement led the 1960s student uprising. And then he worked with the California Peace and Freedom Party. After that, he co-founded the International Socialist. He, like many of its members across the country, were taking jobs in union industries like phone and trucking. Mike went to Detroit, got a job at Chrysler as an electrician, then went to Ford. For most of his life, in fact, he spent time. He worked in the shop with the rank and file, doing organizing that challenged the United Auto Workers Union that was then degenerating into bureaucratic business unionism. Mike was a brilliant writer, doing books accessible to rank and file workers, also left academics. He was a featured speaker at rank-and-file conferences later in life for the last 14 years. He became a main organizer and strategist with the Richmond Progressive Alliance, Richmond, California Progressive Alliance. That's become a great example of how one city, over 100,000 mostly poor folks, could take over city government and win important reforms, including of the police. Today I'll be talking to Jane Slaughter. Welcome to Cable.
Thanks, Bill.
Jane was a longtime comrade with Mike and the International Socialists. She worked on the shop floor at Chrysler, like Mike, but in a different department, and wrote for the UAW Chrysler Plant newsletter. Then she jumped ship to write for the newly formed monthly journal, Labor Notes, the voice of rank and file labor. She was a lead editor until recently, but still writes and speaks a lot, and is active in the Democratic Socialists of America. Along the way, she wrote many articles, several books, including co-authoring two with Mike Parker, Choosing Sides, Unions and the Team Concept, and Working Smart, the Union Guide to Participation Programs and Reengineering. She also edited the Troublemaker's Handbook, too, and co-wrote Secrets of a Successful Organizer. So, Jane, tell us about the International Socialists, your work with Mike Parker, the work in the plant, the organizing, then working together at Labor Notes. Later in the interview, we can discuss your books with Mike and the core ideas that informed those books and both of your organizing.
The International Socialists was a small group of people who had been active mostly in campus struggles, also some community organizing. They had a strong vision of socialism from below. They rejected the way the Soviet Union had turned out and knew that that was a top-down system that they were not trying to organize towards. But they could see that socialist ideas were held by only a tiny minority of people in the United States. And they were trying to figure out how do we help socialist ideas grow in the working class, because, of course, as socialists, we knew that it's the working class that has to fight to end capitalism and replace it with socialism. So one of their ideas for doing that was that they themselves, these young people, and people were all pretty young at that time, would get working class jobs. And they did it in a very strategic way. They tried to figure out which industries were most important and which unions were most important. And so, therefore, people got jobs as auto workers, as steel workers, as teamsters, and as telephone workers, and also some teachers. And their idea was that they would help to organize on the shop floor in those workplaces and help to foment struggle, to put it in a more leftish-sounding way, and that out of those struggles, people could learn, could grow as organizers. We would meet the natural leaders that already existed inside these working-class organizations, and struggles would grow, people's consciousness would grow, and out of that, we could build more of a socialist movement.
In that struggle, Jen, you met Mike Parker, not so much on the Chrysler shop floor where both of you worked. It was a really big plant. But you met them in the political organizations of Detroit, including the organization Solidarity. And you and Mike then began writing. What do you see as the highlights of that work together and the core ideas that formed your writing, especially the books Working Smart and Choosing Sides?
Well, this was where Mike was really brilliant. He was able to organize phenomena that were happening in the unions and in the factories before anybody else really was able to see what was happening. It might be hard for our listeners to really grasp what was happening in the early 80s. First of all, it was a big recession, lots of plant closings. Unions were asked to cut their wages and open their contracts to do that. But at the same time that the companies were aggressively cutting people's jobs and cutting their wages, they were also pretending to hold out an olive branch and say, we can work together, we want your ideas, we shouldn't be antagonists anymore, shouldn't the role of unions be to help the company be profitable, and really trying to obscure the fact that interests of management and workers are opposed. Whatever management gives up is a gain for workers, and whatever workers give up is a gain for management. So, but these programs were very sophisticated. They were called quality circles or quality of work life or employee involvement. And they involved workers meeting together and brainstorming ideas that, you know, often could lead to cutting jobs because the whole idea was more productivity and efficiency and getting people to work harder to do that. It would take a long time to explain all the ins and outs, but Mike was able to analyze these programs in a really sophisticated way that he could get across to workers why these were no good. A lot of people instinctively knew the programs were no good, but they didn't really know how to make the arguments the way Mike did. And so he wrote this first book, Inside the Circle, A Union Guide to Quality of Work Life, which I edited as I was on the staff of Labor Notes. And we published that, and it was a huge success because people were looking for answers. They wanted to know what's going on here and how can we fight these programs or how can we take them over? How can we undermine them? So Mike was really a pioneer in that regard.
My sense was that that period, there was also this fear of Japanese industrialization, and they were going to wipe out so much of U.S. industry by their efficiency and low wages at that point. And the companies played on those themes by saying, we're at war with the Japanese, we have to get more efficient, we have to be able to meet their quality standards, and if you want a job, you have to support the company in that struggle. I think that's part of the reason it was so effective.
Yes, the Japanophobia was very strong at that point, and the unions, some of the unions at least, the auto workers, were totally buying into that and trying to blame things on the Japanese, which in Mike's view, in my view, was very wrong-headed. It's your own employer. It's GM, it's Ford, it's Chrysler who's trying to do these things to you. It's not Japanese workers or even Japanese management. So Mike was able to analyze what was sometimes called the Japanese production system or the Toyota production system, also called lean production, and analyze what that was like and say to people, you know, your own company is adopting this. It's not the Japanese that are imposing this on you. And then also, he was very proud, we were all very proud, that when we held our schools for union workers, we call them team concept schools, we invited a Japanese unionist who was fairly prominent over there in the left wing of the Japanese labor movement. His name was Ben Watanabe, and he came to Detroit and lived in Detroit for a year and was one of Mike's very best friends. And he spoke at all our team concept schools and just really broke down the idea that the Japanese are our enemy, because here was a strong Japanese unionist that had the same union ideas as the American unionists at our schools. So we were very proud of how we were able to fight back against that xenophobic anti-Japanese sentiment.
Jane, I recall a chapter in your book, Working Smart. You suggested that when possible, don't just say no or reject the idea to get into a quality circle or a team, but you suggest that workers can love the quality circle to death by bringing real needs to the table, by suggesting how they can make a better product, like by using higher quality steel, by slowing the line, by having breaks in quiet rooms where you could decompress. I recall reading about the Lucas Aerospace Company in England who was shutting down. The workers organized. They organized to keep the factory open, but proposed a whole set of useful products that could be made at the existing plant with a few equipment modifications. Well, of course, the owners rejected that. But in those meetings, the workers realized that they could rebuild and run that plant. That in the old wobbly saying, the boss's brains, they're under the workers' hats.
Yes, the lure of these programs was that management was saying, we want your ideas. We're sorry we were so mean to you in the past and ignoring workers' ideas. Now we recognize that you do have a brain and we want to get your ideas. But of course, the ideas they wanted were for how to cut jobs. How can we reduce this team from 6 people to 5 people? And that which would mean harder work for everybody and fewer jobs. But what we advised, as you said, Bill, was that the union come in with their own ideas for improving work. Well, how could we improve work on this team? Maybe it would be by increasing it to 7 people or you know, just quality of life things like more water fountains or longer breaks or anything that would improve life for workers. However, we were very insistent that that meant that the union people on the team had to meet separately to come up with those ideas and reinforce each other and be united when they went into the mixed team that was workers and management, workers and the foreman. And, of course, management was completely against that. They said, oh, we're all the same here. You're not supposed to be able to tell union from management. They were completely against any kind of separate meetings. And that's where things would often break down, is that management would refuse the union's request to have the right to do that. And then that exposed management for, you know, for what they were really trying to do.
Yeah, I suppose in those separate meetings, some visionary workers might say, yeah, how can we really change the working conditions and make better products? I think that the workers knew how to make better products. They would just cost more, and the companies would rather make a cheap product that broke down quickly. And, you know, this system of planned obsolescence.
Yes, one of my really major insights was into what management calls quality. What management would call quality was getting the widget that you are producing right 99% of the time instead of 95% of the time. So that was their definition of quality. So how can we make things more standardized, probably use more robots so that we're getting it right 99% of the time? But that did not change the quality of the widget in any way. It was the same widget that they'd been producing all along. They just wanted to make sure there were no mistakes that resulted in scrap, which is waste and therefore cost something. But the quality of the product was no better at all. And so Mike was really good about teasing out management's definition of quality, different from the consumer's notion of quality.
This is KABU Radio 90.7 FM. Bill Resnick talking to Jane Slaughter. We've been discussing her work with Mike Parker, who died recently. They had both industrialized, working on the shop floor in Chrysler's assembly plant. Well, it was a big plant, and they mostly came to know each other outside the plant in political groups where they discussed their work. Mike organized in auto for 30 years. Jane worked on the line and came to edit and write for the UAW, United Auto Workers, Chrysler newsletter. Fired from Chrysler, she joined up with the newly formed monthly Labor Notes, the voice of Rank and File Labor. That began your collaboration, and both of you had a gift for making ideas accessible to workers and accessible to the larger left, including academic and intellectual circles. Tell us about Mike's talks, that he had a gift of holding the audience and getting the audience engaged and thinking. That's because he used examples and parables. He invited listeners to think, which is the advantage of that kind of pedagogy.
Yeah, I think that the common thread running through everything that Mike did was his insistence that people had to run their own organizations and learn how to do that. And that was the only way that people were going to be able to learn how to run society eventually under socialism. If you look at the participation program, he was totally against fake participation and only for real participation, as if workers were really running things. If you look at his later book, I believe it was 1999, Democracy is Power, that he co-authored, that book was about how unions need to be democratic and not just an argument for that, showing that a union is stronger if the members are involved, but giving very practical advice on how to do that. How do you run a meeting democratically, for example? How do you get people to want to be involved in their union? And then finally, the work that you mentioned with the Richmond Progressive Alliance, Mike was just very insistent. It doesn't matter if you win elections if you haven't organized people in their own behalf in the process. He threw himself into electoral work in the last 13, 14 years of his life, but he was always very clear that electoral work was not going to matter if we didn't have a strong labor movement. So that's why he kept his ties to Labor Notes. He was always writing for Labor Notes, giving money to Labor Notes, speaking for Labor Notes. He wanted to see a strong labor movement with the members actually in charge. And in his electoral work, he insisted, we have to have an organization here. We're not just a get-out-the-vote organization. We have to have a membership, a rank-and-file base that democratically controls the Richmond Progressive Alliance, organized people. So that thread, bottom-up worker democracy, was part of everything that he did.
This is Cable Radio, 90.7 FM. Bill Resnick talking to Jane Slaughter. Jane, maybe sum up Mike's achievements. They live on.
Well, I can count three, maybe four, hopefully, organizations that Mike left behind that were really important. First, as we talked about, was the Richmond Progressive Alliance, which has had more electoral success of winning control of the city council and then actually doing things like shifting money from the police budget to other parts of the budget and huge victories against Chevron, thinking about climate change. Way back in 2014, Mike and the RPA were leading a fight against Chevron, which was trying to control their town. Fantastic example of how a giant corporation can be beaten by rank and file shoe leather. That's number one. Number two, of course, is Labor Notes, which for 43 years now has been the voice of the people who want to put the movement back in the labor movement. And Mike's contributions to that through the four books that he wrote and the countless articles that he wrote and all the speaking he did, including in Brazil, Argentina, Japan, his contributions to making Labor Notes a very valuable organization for people who are trying to revitalize the labor movement. I just can't say enough about that. He was a big supporter of Teamsters for a Democratic Union, although he, of course, was not a Teamster himself. But he, you know, was an advisor to Teamster leaders and promoted that. And now there's a new organization in Mike's old union, the United Auto Workers, called Unite All Workers for Democracy, UAWD. And Mike asked that if people wanted to make any donations in his behalf, one of the organizations he picked out for that was UAWD. It's challenging the UAW leadership. They won the right to elect top officials rather than having just convention delegates do it. It's now going to be a vote of the entire rank and file of the UAW, and UAWD will be running candidates to try to help in that process of rank and file taking over. So Mike was extremely heartened to see that at the end of his life. So, yes, he leaves behind a big legacy, both in how do we make the labor movement stronger and smarter, how do we do electoral politics smarter as well.
Jane Sauter, thanks so much for talking to us today.
I could talk about Mike all day long, so I'm happy to do it.
Thank you.
Take care.
This is Patricia Kullberg, and in honor of Black History Month, I would like to highlight the local history of civil rights activism by reading from an essay that I published in Street Roots to mark the 70th anniversary of the flood that wiped out Vanport. A link to the full essay is posted on the Moles webpage at kboo.fm. Vanport, the World War II-era federal housing project on the outskirts of North Portland, was built in a year. It was destroyed in a few hours, engulfed by a massive flood. But in its brief lifespan of 5 years, Vanport birthed a militant anti-racist activism that would supplant the politics of accommodation that prevailed in pre-war Portland. Vanport was sunk down in the rich, dark bottomland of the Columbia River floodplain with two shallow lakes and crisscrossed by sloughs. It was a mile squared off, utterly flat, and enclosed by four dirt levees. The only place to exit that swampy bowl was one road that climbed out on the eastern dike. You couldn't live in Vanport unless you worked for a war industry. Most worked in Henry Kaiser's shipyards. At its peak, the town housed 42,000 people. They came from all over to work for Kaiser. The majority were white, but by war's end, more than 15,000 African Americans had flooded into the area. The local African Americans, fewer than 2,000 total in 1940, were respectable folks who'd worked hard not to call attention to themselves. As described in a wartime study by Black scholar Robert E. Colbert in the Journal of Negro Education, they'd crafted a more or less congenial relationship with white Portlanders, which required a fair amount of looking the other way at local discriminatory practices. The local Blacks did not particularly welcome their new African-American neighbors in Vanport. They were especially fearful that the newcomers would disrupt the status quo, which, in fact, they did. The shipyard wages were eye-popping, so long as you were white. In blatant violation of wartime federal employment rules, African-Americans were offered only the lowest paid and dirtiest work on the shipyards. It was Wyatt Williams, a prominent African-American lawyer in Portland, who helped the Boilermakers Local set up an auxiliary union for African-American workers. The auxiliary collected dues but provided no benefits. No collective bargaining, no grievance procedure, no protection against unfair discipline, and no pathway for advancement. Despite wartime labor shortages, Kaiser fired hundreds of African-American workers who refused to join the Jim Crow auxiliary. Folks didn't stand for it. not Vanport or Julius Rodriguez, president of the local chapter of the Shipyard Negro Organization for Victory, a labor rights organization, not Vanport or Lee Anderson, who sued Kaiser and the Boilermakers for the right to work as a welder, and not Vanport and Communist Party member Sam Markson, who was once arrested for being white in the black section of Vanport, no kidding, and interrogated by the Red Squad, the unit embedded in the Portland Police Bureau to spy on local activists. The local NAACP threw itself into the fray, and so did Bill McClendon, editor of the People's Observer, who covered the conflict in Portland's only wartime newspaper for the African American community. They were all part of the national Double V campaign, Victory Abroad Against Tyranny and Victory at Home Against Racism. In November 1943, the feds investigated the alleged discrimination and issued cease and desist orders. Kaiser and the Boilermakers ignored the orders. In March of 1945, the courts finally ruled in Lee Anderson's favor, the would-be welder. But by then, the shipyards were all but shut down. The neighborhoods of Vanport were largely segregated, illegally and by design, although the Housing Authority of Portland denied it. Not until after the war did activists force the Housing Authority to admit to their practice of keeping secret and separate waiting lists for African Americans and reserving certain neighborhoods for African Americans only. At the end of the war, white families blew out of Vanport as fast as they could, but most of the African Americans were stuck, not welcome in Portland, and not wanting to go back home to even worse conditions. By then, the Vanport Tenants League, or VTL, had organized to challenge the discriminatory practices of the Housing Authority and their failure to apply federal rent relief policies. They staged large, angry demonstrations and alerted the federal overseers to the Housing Authority's illegal circumvention of federal rules. They wrote letters and challenged authorities. They drew the NAACP and the newly formed Urban League of Portland into the fight. Eventually, they forced the Housing Authority to back down. The rain began toward the end of May 1948, a warm deluge. Winter's snowpack ran off the eastern peaks and poured into the Columbia River. The lakes below the western dike of Vanport swelled to twice their size. The western dike was, however, in fact, not a dike, but just a railroad berm. Shortly after 4 p.m. on Memorial Day, the sirens went out. The dike that was actually not a dike had burst. Within the hour, all the buildings were adrift in muddy, swirling waters. Cars and buses bobbed about like bathtub toys. Residents were stranded on the roofs. A chain of men in water to their knees pulled one person after another to higher ground. 18,000 persons were instantly homeless. Scores were injured. 15 dead was the official count. Most Vanporters lost nearly everything they owned. In the aftermath of the flood, the Vanport Tenants League joined with other activists to protest not only the lack of compensation, but the housing of flood victims in rotten conditions, in dilapidated trailers and former dormitories for shipyard workers. Meetings were disrupted, marches were staged, a caravan to Salem was organized, pickets were dispatched with signs that decried post-war relief for Europe, but nothing for the displaced shipyard workers. Vanport was never built to last, but rather to service the industrial needs of a wartime economy and in the process to maintain certain race and class boundaries. But Vanport activists and their allies took up the fight for a better future for their kids. With their mass demonstrations and pickets and marches and impolite disruptions of official meetings, they were the first to challenge the politics of accommodation that characterized the pre-war African-American community in Portland. It was these men and women who set the stage for the civil rights protests to come. This is Patricia Kohlberg for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I've been reading from an essay of mine about the history of civil rights activism in Vanport. Everything is everything. What is meant to be will be.
Everything is Everything by Lauryn Hill here on the Old Mole Variety Hour, and Patricia Kohlberg sharing her Street Roots essay. Up next for their Left and the Law segment, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker discuss The Color of Law, a book published in 2017 by Richard Rothstein. The author explains how white supremacy and structural racism have been reproduced by laws around real estate and the intergenerational transfer of wealth. Jan and Mike also discuss how these same laws have shaped Oregon's racial history.
This is Black History Month, and much of that history unfolds under the long shadow of white supremacy and segregation. Mike, you wanted to talk today about The Color of Law, a book by Richard Rothstein, who shows how laws in the U.S. have reproduced patterns of de jure segregation rather than de facto segregation. These are two terms associated with the mechanisms of segregation. Before taking up the substance of Rothstein's work, can you explain these two terms and the importance of this distinction he's making?
Well, his book is extraordinary and very important because he demolishes assumptions made by the U.S. Supreme Court and by most of us about how segregation comes about and how it was created here in the United States. De jure segregation is a bad thing, according to the U.S. Supreme Court. It means it's segregation that's legally caused, whether laws separating the races or excluding one race from benefits awarded to another. Whereas de facto segregation is what happens when there's unscrupulous real estate agents or people who, because of their own predilections, live out a life in such a way that they end up picking environments to live in and places to go that exclude other races. And there is not a place where the Constitution goes.
I mean, that's often in the area of unconscious racial biases, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So that's the difference. And what Rothstein's book does in a nutshell, in all great books like Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow on the subject, can be reduced to a nutshell, is that he shows that the myth relied on, the comfortable fiction relied on by the U.S. Supreme Court, that segregation in this country is de facto, is wrong. That there have been explicit laws passed that have shaped neighborhoods and forced people to live in places that they would otherwise not choose to live in because of laws. And he shows how these laws evolved primarily from the 1930s and from the New Deal.
Can you provide some of the key laws that he describes in this trajectory that's important partly not only as it relates to racism and segregation, but as the accumulation of wealth and the intergenerational transfer of wealth through home ownership?
Well, quick flashback to history. In 1934, when the Federal Housing Agency, or FHA, was created, America was a nation of renters. To buy a house was a tricky thing. Mortgages were limited to 50% of the house's value. The loans were like 3 to 5 years with a giant balloon payment at the end. Only 1 in 10 households in this country owned a house. So what happened was that everything changed in the 30s. The laws were passed allowing the federal government to insure loans. The concept of a 30-year loan was created, 20% down payments, and the insurance of loans enable banks to lend money extensively. They also, at that time, created public housing, which had not existed before. And there was a series of laws, and particularly important were the financial arrangements that allowed loans to happen, that enabled America to become what it is now, a nation of homeowners. But all these laws were explicitly limited to white people. That was part of the deal, of the New Deal, is that it was a coalition of urban workers and intellectuals and Southern segregationists. And the only way Southerners would vote for these laws was if Black people were excluded.
Was this explicit or more in the subtext?
This was very explicit. This was debated, and it was no secret for decades. We now have suppressed how explicitly racist the U.S. was, particularly in the middle of the 20th century. In Oakland, California, for example, you would be kicked off the real estate board for selling a house to a black person as late as 1967. These laws did not change. These explicitly segregationist laws only changed with the Federal Housing Act of 1968. But by then, shortly thereafter, is when the notion of real property really became a big deal.
The Oregon legislature did a report in 2019 on racial discrimination in lending and found that even 50 years after the Federal Fair Housing Act that you cite, Black people continue to be denied mortgages, charged higher rates during the subprime era and the scandals associated with that. Many of them were disproportionately pushed on Black families. And it does raise the question of how progressive something like the Federal Fair Housing Act of 1969 was. Are these kind of hollow reforms? Can you say something about that and how Rothstein kind of assesses not only the depths of the legal segregation and legal denial of access to one means of achieving and transferring wealth, which is through home ownership to Black people. But how then do we assess that period of reforms and that did not deliver much? But does that mean they are simply hollow or a facade in a certain sense?
Not at all. The reforms have made things better. They've certainly not made things perfect. But the explicit de jure segregation that lasted until 1968 shaped everything in a way that's really hard to rearrange. Let's look at what happened. I mean, in the 40s, you could buy a house in Levittown right after World War II for $8,000. That was its equivalent now of about $100,000.
Where's Levittown?
It's right out of New York City. It's uh-huh. Levittown in Pennsylvania as well. The suburbs were built for white people. And at that time, people didn't realize the import of these houses because housing was just no big thing. You could buy a house with a year or two's income. You know, houses were $20,000 as late as the late 60s in California, as well as everywhere else. In Oregon, houses were $10,000, $15,000, $20,000. And Black people had plenty of work after World War II. They could easily afford these houses, but they were not allowed to buy them. They were simply excluded from suburbs all over the country. Now, that's at a time when America's work was manufacturing primarily, and Black people have always had a much easier time getting jobs manufacturing than in face-forward positions like bank tellers, where banks would be reluctant to hire them. So there was plenty of money around and plenty of efforts.
And a lot of the unionization of industrial jobs allowed many Black people to enter, in a sense, the middle class.
Yes. But what happened is, right in the early 70s, that's when the whole concept of real property took on the power that it has today. It meant really little before that. You could be a janitor and afford to buy a house. Anybody could buy a house if you chose to in almost any part of this country. Until the 70s, the 1970s. At that time, real estate took off. And now it's at the place where even well-to-do white young people cannot afford a house. Houses have become objects of incredible value. They've gone up in value hundreds of times. I mean, I know that this group that I was working for, a prisoners union, bought a three-story Victorian house in San Francisco for $35,000 in 1975. Is now worth over $2 million. Houses have gone up. Even those Levittown houses that were worth sold initially for $8,000 are now worth about $300,000, $350,000. There have been a massive appreciation of assets. Along with the loss of jobs, the manufacturing jobs, there's been asset inflation of every sort of asset, stocks, but primarily real estate. And that is the main source of intergenerational wealth. So at this present time, white people make about, let me turn it around, Black people make about 60% of what white people do in their work, but they have about 5% of the wealth. That's almost entirely due to the fact that they have been excluded from housing, which is the source of, as you say, intergenerational wealth.
And these are compounding effects over time that explain the widening income inequality and race and class divide in this country.
Yes, and Rothstein shows how many other forms of law, for example, zoning, how zoning, you know, toxic industries or waste-filled industries were excluded from white areas, but not from black areas. He shows how public housing was explicitly race-based. He shows how restrictive covenants continued, that is, covenants that forbade anyone from selling a house to a black person, were in effect until the 60s. And finally, he shows that, well, one of the many little pleasures of the book, he shows that the idea that black people moving in to a neighborhood would lower the property values was precisely wrong. What typically happened, black people have been forced, because of the restricted access to housing, to pay more for their houses than white people have. So what has happened in neighborhoods around Chicago, for example, is that a black person would move in, would pay more, and then rumors would be spread by real estate agents who would get white houses at a discounted rate for fear that there would be a black invasion, and then those same houses would be sold to African Americans for more money than they would have been worth previously. So consistently, there's an effect of improvement in the property values where black people are allowed to buy homes.
And many of these same patterns, of course, have been documented in Oregon. There are some really wonderful exhibits, including online lectures through the Oregon Historical Society, that listeners may want to check out during Black History Month. So, Mike, in closing, what are the implications of this sobering history that, of course, the move now to ban books around the country that make white people uncomfortable? This is probably on that list. It can make you very uncomfortable, especially realizing the cumulative effects of this. And then the question is, what are the implications of this for forms of reparation and not only being disturbed and shocked, but what do we have a moral obligation to do in response to this form of legally sanctioned segregation and white supremacy?
It's hard. It's a lot harder than changing drug laws or getting rid of the death penalty or changing criminal justice laws. It's because now it's so ingrained and embedded. The whole phenomenon of asset inflation was in effect beginning in the 70s and continuing to today. You know, it started after things were set in stone, in that the suburbs, which are now passing ordinances constantly trying to keep other places from being built in them or around them, it's really difficult. It's an area that cries out for remedies, but it's the most difficult of all.
So
any snappy answer. I do know that the reparations, the notion of reparations, people think of slavery, but when you think that black people were legally deprived of hundreds of billions of dollars of value because of explicit laws, then you think reparations is a more modern concept than most people suppose.
So with that, we close for today and continue to follow this. It's in a way promising that the movement for reparations has gained some not only moral legitimacy, but political legitimacy in recent years.
It has to begin with a recognition of how systematically our laws and the formal structures of society have deprived black people of massive amounts of wealth before we can even start to do anything about it.
Thanks, Mike. We'll continue to follow this.
Of all the evil that will have to end.
It will, oh yes, it will. Don't you look to me.
All right.
It will end.
Well, all right.
Well, all right.
not as simple as talking jive. The daily struggle just to stay alive.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. That was Revolution by Nina Simone. It followed Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talking about The Color of Law, a book by Richard Rothstein. Up next, Larry Bolden reviews The Last House on the Street by mystery writer Diane Chamberlain, combining her love of mystery writing with her concern for voter registration in her most recent novel. The lives of two women converge in this story about voter registration and the 1964 killing of civil rights workers in the South. Patricia Kohlberg reads for Larry Bolden.
Good morning. This is Patricia Kohlberg, and today I'm reading a review by Larry Bolden of the latest novel by Diane Chamberlain. Chamberlain is a very famous mystery writer, and her 2021 novel, The Last House on the Street, lives up to her reputation. However, this novel is also very relevant to the times because the underlying theme concerns voter registration and attempts to keep black voters from registering. In her author's notes, Chamberlain tells us that she was 14 during the summer of 1964 when three civil rights workers were killed while trying to register black voters. Later, while in high school, she happens across information on the SCOPE program, the summer voter registration program of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. What she learns stays with her and eventually informs this novel. The novel itself is the story of two women, Ellie Hockley, who, in 1965, becomes interested in the SCOPE program after learning that college kids from the North are traveling to North Carolina to help blacks register to vote. More of that soon. The second strand of the novel occurs in 2010, when Kayla Carter, an architect, is about to move into a beautiful home that she and her husband designed together. Her husband is killed in an accidental fall while working on the house. Although heartbroken, Kayla decides that she and her 3-year-old daughter, Rainey, will move into the dream house that is nestled in dark woods and is the last house on the street and the first house in the upscale neighborhood to be completed. Kayla gets a surprise visit from a woman with bright red hair and large reflector sunglasses that she keeps on even indoors. The woman, Ann Smith, says she wants Kayla to design an addition to her home, but in the course of her visit, she tells Kayla that she should not move into the new house, claiming the woods around the house are haunted, and out of the blue, she tells Kayla that she is thinking about killing someone. Quote, "I've been thinking about it for a long, long time," she continues. "Years and years and years, and now I have the chance." End quote. Ann Smith leaves the office after this short but alarming conversation, but Kayla is unnerved by the threats and even more apprehensive about moving into her new home. Back to Ellie's story. Her conservative fiancé and her parents are aghast at hearing that Ellie plans to join the group of Northern students to become a member of SCOPE. Ellie is shocked at just how adamant her parents are in resisting her plans and how quickly her friends turn on her. The story is a long and complicated one, but suffice it to say that slowly the two stories begin to merge. Acts of vandalism and written threats continue against Kayla, including threats to harm Rainey. And she comes to learn that a field behind her house and surrounded by her woods was once used by the Ku Klux Klan as a meeting site. Ellie loves her work with SCOPE, although the townspeople make life as miserable as they can for the young workers, and Ellie comes to learn more and more about the bigotry of her friends and family. When she has the audacity to fall in love with one of the black SCOPE workers, the full extent of the prejudices and fears of her family and friends become manifest. I won't say more about how the two stories finally come together, but the research Chamberlain has done on the civil rights movement is obvious. This novel is more important to her than the immediate mystery, and the social political content is much more important to this reader than the story itself. And yet, the complicated plot stands on its own, even without the political commentary. I have read other mysteries by Chamberlain, but none as socially relevant and as significant as this one. I have been talking about Diane Chamberlain's newest book, The Last House on the Street. This is Larry Bolden for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I am Patricia Kohlberg, reading for Larry, our book mole.
That's the Old Mole Variety Hour for February 7th, 2022. I'm John Nelson. Two notes before we go. First, a reminder that Wednesday, February 9th, is the fifth anniversary of the murder of 17-year-old Quantas Moose Hayes by Portland police. The film Silent Voices depicts the stories of Moose, Kendra James, Aaron Campbell, and six other people killed by Portland police. It will live stream every hour from noon to midnight through Eventbrite. The play, produced by Open Signal Cable TV, was written by Moose's grandmother, Donna Hayes, and directed by Kendall. The performance is dedicated to Moose Hayes and to his great-grandmother, Sylvia Dollarson, who passed away in December. She had a lifelong passion for confronting injustice. You can find registration information by searching Silent Voices on Eventbrite. Also, a note about the Cascade Festival of African Films. Last Monday, listeners heard Jan Hocken interview AJ One about his film Diatribe that screened opening night at the annual Cascade Festival of African Films here in Portland. We'll be hearing more from AJ One later this month as he talks with Jan further about black history and hip-hop and discusses another locally produced film, Moving to the Beat, which screened at the festival some years back. The Old Mole regularly reviews films and ways of thinking about movies in the context of social movements and as a form of culture work. The Cascade Festival of African Films is very much in that spirit of working with moving images outside of the corporate-dominated cultural frame. And we're fortunate in Portland to have this film festival institution that has been, like KABU, sustained for decades through the passionate commitment of volunteers. The Cascade Festival of African Films is the longest-running annual, non-profit, non-commercial, largely volunteer-run African film festival in the United States. The tagline for the festival is Africa Through the Eyes of Africans, a vision of Africa packaged for Western viewers. The films celebrate Africa's achievements, expose its failures, and reveal possibilities for a hopeful future. This is the 32nd year of showing Africa through African lenses, with a curated collection of films by African directors from over 18 nations, live interviews with filmmakers, community conversations, and more. The program includes four in-person events held at the Hollywood and Clinton Street Theaters. All films, with one exception, will also be available to watch online. For more program and scheduling details, go to AfricanFilmFestival.org. That's www.AfricanFilmFestival.org. Thanks again for tuning in, and thanks to Bill Resnick and his guest Jane Slaughter, and to Jan Hocken, Mike Snedeker, Larry Bolden, and Patricia Kohlberg. You can find this episode alongside other archived episodes of The Old Mole in Time at KBOO.FM. Just search for The Old Mole Variety Hour. Suggestions, comments, or questions can be sent from the webpage there or to oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com.